Welcome to the Super Gamer Podcast. Welcome to the new Super Gamer Podcast, episode 178. Our guest this week is a gaming and children's librarian and the past president for the Games and Gaming Roundtable of the American Library Association. We have Rebecca Strang. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with what a librarian actually does, because I think on the surface, like when the word comes into my head, I'm like, oh yeah, the person who helps me find a book at the library. But like, you're like an events coordinator, you're a curator, you know, you're a teacher. Like, what all do you do?
Yeah, a librarian is a pretty big hat, and it's going to vary pretty broadly depending on what kind of library setting that person's working in. I'm a children's librarian at a public library in Northern Illinois, and in my day job, I definitely help people, you know, connect with books that they're going to love to read. But I also manage gaming collections. So I do, when we're talking about books, we talk a lot about reader's advisory. So I do a lot of player's advisory where I'm helping connect people to games. I run programming at my library. So I do a lot of our games programs. Surprise, surprise. I run a board game night for families. And I also run a program that is a tabletop role-playing game club for third to sixth graders. I run a Pokemon club where we play the card game. We do a lot of trivia. We play Pokemon Go with the kids and families that show up. And I also run a video game club where we play stuff on the Switch or on iPads. Lots of Minecraft. It's still popular after all these years. And then I also run other programs like 3D printing, and I do a lot of story time programs too. And then we also have, you know, the collection development and maintenance that we do. So I have book collections, but also game collections. I actually had a cool experience at the library I'm currently at. When I started, we did not have a board game collection. So I got to propose that collection and help with the development and getting that collection into the library, which was really exciting and has been really well received by our community, which is great to see. So bringing new things into the library is something that librarians do a lot too. And then you'd mentioned my work with the American Library Association. So with that, I work with librarians across the world, really, not just here in the United States, to get gaming collections and programs into their libraries. I've done webinars and trainings for librarians in the UK and Trinidad Tobago and other places around the world, and definitely in other states here in the US, to help them just learn more about gaming and how to get those collections into their spaces. And we just connect with people. We build community, whether it's around the books that they're reading or the games that they're playing, helping them with research, homework, all that kind of stuff. And that's what I do as a public librarian.
Okay, well, where are libraries with games these days? Like, is it largely accepted and encouraged, or do you have to fight for space? I did notice on the library that you work at, on the website, there isn't any obvious game section.
Yeah, we don't have a game page on the website itself, so you'd have to delve into our catalog for that, or look at our events calendar to see some of that programming. I mean, gaming has been in libraries for decades, but as far as, you know, more widely circulating collections, it is a relatively newer thing in libraries, and definitely something that a lot of librarians have had to fight for to get into their libraries and still have to fight for a little bit. When people think of libraries, you know, obviously the first thing they think of is books and kind of this, you know, quiet, studious place. So games are sometimes viewed as something that's just recreational, or, you know, some people think of gaming as almost like a waste of time kind of thing. But I mean, recreation is something that comes naturally to humans. Like, play in and of itself is a perfect end. It, you know, you don't have to be getting an an academic end out of everything that we do. So having games for the purpose of play is perfectly fine, but games are also useful in education and storytelling, which is something that connects with the mission of pretty much any library that you look at. So we do help people, you know, people come to the Games and Gaming Roundtable of the American Library Association, often asking us for advice on how to convince their upper management that games are something worthwhile, something that they should be spending their time and money on in providing for their community. And for those of us in the roundtable, it's a pretty easy sell. Libraries offer a space for people to access things that they may not otherwise have the financial means to do so. We do that with books, we do that with other technology. So games are just a natural extension of that space. Not everybody can afford to buy games brand new. Even board games can be expensive, but video games too. So libraries providing the space and access for people to experience those things is a great thing that libraries do. And when we can connect those connections, when we can connect those collections with the programming that we do, it makes it even better because we can literally give people space to play when we have programs by using our meeting rooms and connecting our community members in those, you know, interpersonal moments when you're playing games.
You said on the Portable Magic Dispenser podcast a little over a year ago that you try to avoid Dungeons and Dragons and campaign style RPGs for the middle grade kids because you never know, like, if the same kids are going to be showing up session to session. And I had to laugh because I feel like that's the exact same problem that adults have.
It is. Yeah, my own home D&D group, we definitely have our own scheduling conflicts that we're always having to resolve. But when I run an RPG club, it's for third to sixth graders. And while we do have a lot of regulars, we've had this program for 3 years now, which is kind of wild. It doesn't seem like it's been that long. But we have some regulars, but we definitely have, you know, a group that is in flux from month to month. So we like to focus on games that we can explain the rules, create a character, play the actual session, and then have a little bit of debrief time all in 90 minutes. And with Dungeons and Dragons, doing that with kids is a little difficult because you could spend that much time just explaining the rules to Dungeons and Dragons to adults, let alone kids. So we like to focus on some smaller, like one-page RPGs or role-playing games that have been specifically designed for kids, like No Thank You Evil or Amazing Tales, things like that, so that we can get through all of those points we want to hit in 90 minutes.
I was going to recommend to you, but I've seen you've played it already, Magical Kitties Save the Day, which is a great kid-friendly D&D.
Yeah, we love Magical Kitties Save the Day. And actually, one of the artists who did some work on that game, Bridget Indelico, she did the brand new logo for the Games and Gaming Roundtable. So yeah, we definitely love Magical Kitties Save the Day.
What powers would your real life cats have, do you think?
Oh my gosh, I have 4 cats at home, and their magical powers. One of our youngest cat, Bacchus, would probably want teleportation. He's always trying to get into everything, and it would be a lot easier if he could just teleport everywhere and right into the cabinets, which is where he's always trying to get. And probably Nox would love, you know, if she could just conjure food, like, you know, a mage from World of Warcraft or something. That would be her magical power. Maybe being invisible, too. They might like that.
I have one cat, and I'm obsessed with him. He's my first ever pet, and I love him to death. but he's very much, food crazy. And I was trying to think of my own, and I think it'd be like a Kirby kind of thing. Like, he would eat, and then he'd get that power.
Yeah. That would be funny.
So GameRT, the Games and Gaming Roundtable, what does a past president do? I don't know what that role is.
Sure. So the way that the roundtable is built, as far as our what the board looks like, we have a secretary, a treasurer, and then we have, when you become a president, it's kind of a 3-year term, and your first term as in that presidential trio, you are the president-elect, and then you move into the president role and then the past president role. So as past president, I am there to help the current president and president-elect as they step into their roles, help with any initiatives that I started in my presidential role, kind of wrapping those up. And the past president also heads up our strategic planning and nominations committee. So I'm helping with, you know, bringing in new people to the roundtable for our general membership, as well as finding folks who want to run for our other board positions. I've been on the board for 6 years and a general member for a few years more than that. So I've gotten to know a lot of our membership, and I love when I can find new members who are super active and want to be active with volunteering on some of our committees, and then eventually helping those folks run for a board position to shape the work that we do. So all of that is kind of encompassing my past president role.
Are you hands-on at all for the upcoming International Games Week in November?
I am not on that committee, but I definitely, you know, we all help out with recruiting potential publishers to sponsor that initiative and making connections with helping libraries get signed up to participate in that event. At my own library, we're actually running a 6-hour special gaming event in November for International Games Month, and I'm on the planning committee for that event at my specific library. So yeah, a lot of us on the board are active with getting that initiative going every year.
Cool. Do you kind of know what you're doing already at your library, or?
Yeah, at my library, we are going to have a few different stations set up throughout the day. We're going to have an area where kids and families can take a look at some different games from around the world, even some older games. And we're featuring them sort of as print and plays, like copyright-free versions of older games like Ludo that you can print out and have it to play there at the library, but you know, you could print those things out and experience games from other countries at home too. We're also going to have what we're calling the Tabletop Tavern, where folks can check out some of our tabletop role-playing materials. There's going to be some crafts. They're like a D20 necklace that some of the folks are making, and miniature painting. And then we're partnering with a local company called Critical Grind Gaming. They help organizations run gaming events. So they're going to bring in some games from their collection to supplement the games that we have in our collection so that we have more on hand for that day. And they also provide some of their staff to help with teaching folks how to play games. So we'll have some additional games teachers on hand. And then we're going to be running a bingo session. And then we'll have a craft table set up for kids. One of the crafts that I'm running is helping kids make a paper craft that's one of the TNT blocks from Minecraft, and then like some other coloring sheets and Animal Crossing masks.
What kind of games do you find, like, obviously there's a whole gamut of games there, but what kind do you find that kids tend to gravitate towards, like, when they're at the library?
In the children's section, which is the specific board game collection that I manage, a lot of the stuff we see families using are from the publisher Haba. They focus on publishing children's games, and a lot of their components are, you know, sometimes like these oversized wooden pieces that are great for playing the game that they were designed for. But one of the things that I love about the games that HABA publishes is that they often include additional suggestions for ways to use the game components for imaginative play or storytelling, which is great for families who may not be as familiar with the gaming hobby, that they can use these game pieces in other ways or just for imaginative play, which is how kids naturally play anyway. So those games have been really popular, but also some of the classics like Clue is always popular, and Sorry and things like that have been popular too. And some newer stuff like Abandon All Artichokes or some of the Peaceable Kingdom stuff like Hoot Owl Hoot, things like that.
Well, the imaginative play there, I think, is probably the best segue we're going to get to Tiny Library Modern Fantasy, which is more than 50% funded right now.
Yes.
And it's 51 cards from various creators, and they're all one-shots, maybe the wrong term, because it's like, it's not a full game in itself, the card, but each card is sort of like prompts that you can use in whatever RPG-style game you want. Am I getting that right?
Yes. They're basically... So each card is what we call a fragment. Every card in this pack has been designed using the Mosaic strict design philosophy. And Mosaic stands for modular, optional, short, attested, independent, and coreless. So each of these cards, while not a full game in itself, is something that you could either insert into something that you're running like D&D or Blades in the Dark, literally anything. You could just pop it in there, or you could take several of these individual cards and just make a game to play with the rules on these cards. So for example, the card that I designed that is in there is called Trash Companion, and it is it's a companion, rules for a companion that you would have in your game, an animal companion. And this companion, you meet it as it's a raccoon when you first meet it, but it is a magical creature that can also turn into a pigeon. So there are rules for how it can transform depending on the time of day, and then it has different abilities in both of its forms. One ability is a boon, and one ability is a bane. So the raccoon, for example, has tiny hands and is great at, you know, getting into small places, and it can fetch things for you, but it's also a raccoon and it might be stealing things, taking stuff when you have not commanded it to do so, which can cause problems for you. So that's something that you could insert as a companion, you know, in an existing game, or just combine it with a few of the other cards from the Tiny Library deck to make a brand new game.
And people can back that at gamefound.com.
Yes. If you go to GameFound and just search for Tiny Library Modern Fantasy, you'll find that there. It's being published by Longtail Games. And this is actually the third installment in this kind of tiny game series that they've been doing. They have the first Tiny Library, which was just 50 business card sized role-playing game or games, like full games that fit on a business card. And they also did Tiny Tome, which was a collection of one-page RPGs by 50 different creators. So it's a really cool way to get some of these indie creators, or even people who've never had any games published before, an outlet for publishing with a bunch of other creators. And it's some of the stuff that's in this deck is really cool.
Yeah, and you did it, everyone, it was part of a game jam, right? Like there was 100 and something entrants and 51 this time got chosen.
Yeah, it did start as a game jam on Itch, itch.io. And there were 100, I think 121 submissions. A lot of us submitted several things. I submitted three things. I think a lot of people submitted three because three was the max that you could submit to the jam. And then, Ash, the person who was running the jam, then had to take those 121 entries. And the initial goal was to get it down to 50, but they ended up making it 51 because there's too much cool stuff.
When can we see Trash Companion version 2.0, which I know you are considering or working on already?
Yeah, I have the template for it is basically done, but I have lots of ideas for other little magical companion duos. The next one is going to be a possum that is also a bat. Just a lot of animal companion requests have been coming into me, so it's kind of fun to think of the different like boons and banes that each version of these animals would have and figuring out how that's going to work. But I'll soon. I don't have an exact date, but soon.
I know similarly, like in some of the play that you do at your work, you get kids to design their own games. Has anything ever stood out for you where you're like, wow, that kid made a really cool idea?
My favorite thing as far as making games, we did for International Games Month last year, our Kids RPG Club did a collaborative game jam where we hacked a game called Lasers and Feelings, which is a one-page role-playing game with an open license for kind of modding or hacking it however you'd like. If for folks who aren't familiar with Lasers and Feelings, in the game, you have two stats, lasers and feelings, and you use one of those stats for any of the decision making that you're doing in the game. And we turned our hack of that into a dinosaur themed game called Hunt and Hide. We picked dinosaurs as a theme because in the library world, November is also known as Dinovember, so it's dinosaur themed everything. But they had a lot of fun just trying to figure out how they could take this existing game. And then once we had the theme, figuring out how to rework some of those mechanics into things that would make sense for dinosaurs to be doing. And that was a lot of fun with them to work on that. And I've also run a kind of board game design program where kids were just making up their own games. And I think my favorite project from that was one of the girls had designed this game that was all about owning a dog shampooing company where she would, during the game, you'd have to find, you know, clients who wanted their dogs to basically have a spa day, and then running the dogs through all of the different stations in this little dog spa. It was really cool to see her come up with how that would work.
Cool, yeah. One board game mod that you created that I think is just such a great idea, and I should have looked up if it exists elsewhere, but I didn't. But you created a Pokemon themed Guess Who, which, like, yeah,
yes.
Kids must love that.
Yeah, we a lot of the various Pokemon game things I've created kind of stemmed out of the COVID-19 pandemic, because we had been running Pokemon Club in person at the library, but then when everything shut down, libraries really had to pivot, and a lot of our programming went from being in person to being online. And so we were trying to think of how we could create fun, engaging activities that we could do with our kids over Zoom, still Pokemon themed. So I made this digital Pokemon, we called it Pokey Who, but it's, you know, just a riff on Guess Who. And we just created digital versions of some of these classic games with a Pokemon theme so that we could run them over Zoom with our kids and still keep them engaged and entertained in a virtual space.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's so much you could do with that, I think.
Yeah.
something we probably should have talked about way before, but anyway, how did you go from pre-med chemistry to advertising to game studies to librarian?
It was an interesting journey. I had wanted to be, from the time I was 5 to the time I was 21, I was dead set on being a pediatric cardiologist. Cause I have a heart murmur, and when I was a kid, I was constantly at the hospital, like getting various kinds of tests and things like that done. And it was just so fascinating to me that that's what I wanted to do. So I was just set on that for most of my life. It kind of just became this thing that was expected of me. And I loved chemistry. Like, I loved my chemistry classes. They were a lot of fun for me. But my sophomore year of college, I took a photography class, and we were doing darkroom work, and there's a lot of chemistry involved there. And I just fell in love with photography, so much so that I changed my major that year, to the surprise of everyone. And pursued that for a while. And then I ended up taking a very long break after my junior year of college, just life and family stuff going on. And by the time I went back to school, I had already been doing photography professionally for a few years. So when I went back to finish my bachelor's degree, I didn't feel the need to, you know, continue pursuing a bachelor's in photography. So I was just looking at other things that I could do, and kind of fell into the School of Communication at Loyola and was looking at advertising and marketing. And through the course of doing that, Florence Chi, who is a professor at Loyola, she started there shortly after I had went back to finish up my bachelor's degree, and she was teaching a game studies class, which I was super interested in, because you know, all through middle school and high school, you know, my friends and I, like, we would have LAN parties and stuff, and I was into board games and all of that already. So a class on game studies just seemed really, really cool to me. So I took that class, and the rest is kind of history. I continued pursuing game studies in a lot of my coursework. I ended up, my major there was actually in film and digital media, more on the digital media side of that, with a focus in game studies. And I did my senior capstone project on looking at the representation of women in both games, but also in the gaming community. And I was really in love with how community is built around games and how games can bring people together. And I was just trying to figure out, like, how do I make a job out of bringing people together with games? And kind of started thinking about libraries a bit. So I got a part-time job at a library just to see if it was a good fit for me, and ended up loving it. So I then went on to get my master's in library science. And now my job is just games all the time. I get to play games with people all the time at the library, and it's really great.
So it sounds like you never had the problem, like, when I said, oh, when I think library, you know, oh, help me find my book. Sounds like before you even got the job, you knew, no, this is a place to build community in various ways.
Yeah, I, as a kid, when I was in school, I lived in the libraries. Like, I would spend my free period in the library. I read a lot as a kid. Books were a huge escape for me, but I was like one of those nerdy kids who knew the librarian really well and like actually liked talking to them and hanging out with them. So I saw a lot of the stuff that they did, and I knew that, you know, libraries were not just this place where people tell you to shush all the time, but it was more a community hub where people can feel safe and find things that they're interested in. You can explore at the library, you can learn at the library, you can have fun at the library, and that's what libraries have always been for me. So when I was looking for a place where I could, you know, continue doing games but building community, it just seemed like a natural fit for me.
Please take this as the compliment that I mean it to be. Your dice bracers are the nerdiest thing I've ever seen.
I love my dice bracers. My husband gave those to me as, I believe, a birthday gift, that or an anniversary gift. I don't know. We gift random nerdy stuff to each other all the time. But yes, I love those dice bracers. I have definitely worn them to work for Adventurers Club. The kids love them. They really like when we dress up. They get a kick out of that. So yeah, they're super cool. I love them.
If anyone's wondering what dice bracers are, it's like a medieval style like leather bracer, but with like pockets to hold, you know, D&D style dice.
Yeah. Each bracer, you could have a full polyhedral set on each one, in each die in its own little individual pocket.
When your old library did a Harry Potter themed escape room, how much of the decor came directly from your house?
Like 95 to 99% of it. And not because it's specifically Harry Potter stuff. It's just things you would find in a wizard lair. I don't know. We've got lots of random geekery around the house, like wizard staves and crystals and a dragon skull with dice in it, and just our house is just a little wizard den, basically.
What about when I first contacted you, I mentioned the playability pod, and you were like, yeah, it doesn't really exist anymore, but you can still listen to it.
Yeah.
What happened? So it's a podcast on gaming and accessibility and where they intersect. Why is it no more?
Well, the pandemic hit, and myself and my co-host, Lauren Woolsey, who is a college professor, our schedules just blew up when the pandemic hit. I don't think a lot of people realize how hard teachers and librarians were hit by the pandemic, because, I mean, literally everything that we do had to transition from being in person to online. So a lot of people were learning completely new technology, learning to do, you know, presenting and recording and doing all of this stuff online, which not only learning how to do that online portion of it, but taking our existing programs and figuring out ways to translate them into a virtual space. And it was a lot of work. So our schedules really just blew up. And we didn't have a lot of bandwidth for it, unfortunately, but not only our schedules, but a lot of the people that we had scheduled for interviews had to cancel, you know, either due to their own illness or somebody else's illness, or just everyone's life was blowing up at the time. And we just haven't found a way back to doing that. So it's just kind of turned into a more permanent hiatus.
Do you have a favorite interview that you did?
I think my favorite interview is the one that I did with Isaac Vega. Isaac did design work on Dead of Winter and some of those Crossroads games. And I think a lot of the reasons that I love that interview is because we did talk a lot about games and community, which is super dear to my heart. But he's a super cool dude and super nice and makes really cool games. And it was just a lovely conversation.
And in what ways do you try to make your gaming sessions at work more accessible? Like, what has to be front of mind all the time?
Well, working with our age group, one of the things that we do for a lot of the games that we play is we will create our own version of the character sheets. whether we're editing things out because we're stripping some of the rules to fit the time that we need, or we're adding extra things in that the game by default did not include. A lot of our kids love to draw. They like to draw their characters. They like to draw the scene that we're currently in. They like to draw the animal companions that they have. And we noticed right away that was like giving them either a scratch paper or a spot on their character sheet where they could draw or doodle or scribble during play helps them focus. So just editing things like that. We also encourage kids to, if they need like fidgets or something, we do try to steer them away from electronic fidgets and focus on non-electronic fidgets. But, you know, that also helps some of our kids maintain focus during play. And we'll also try to work more in a turn order style versus everybody kind of trying to talk at once, just to make sure that everybody gets a chance to be heard and think about what they want to do. And some of it too is just the more that our kids repeat and come back, we get to know them more. So we learn how to, you know, coax the shyer players into joining the conversation more, providing a kind of safe space for them to open up. We also have, as far as like accessibility to the materials, we provide dice and pencils and all of that for everybody during the session, so they don't have to worry about bringing those things from home. Especially if, you know, they can't afford it, or some of their parents don't, like when we talk to them about all of the different types of dice that we use, they don't know what all of that means. So we try to have all of that stuff on hand so that the kids don't have to worry about whether or not they're going to have the stuff that they need to play. We've got all of that on hand. And we also do a lot of theater of the mind play. We don't use a lot of miniatures or like battle maps and things in Adventurers Club, because playing in theater of the mind gets, you know, those creative juices flowing. It helps with they're having fun and they're playing these games, but it helps with building those creative and critical thinking skills as well.
Access to materials leads to the last thing I'm going to ask you here. With video games going digital more and more, does that create problems for libraries?
Yeah, it's an interesting little conundrum for libraries, for sure. There is not a really great way for libraries to circulate digital games. And for PC stuff, Steam has their Steam PC Cafe, where not only libraries, but any like internet cafes and things like that can subscribe to their service to provide access to digital stuff where the player doesn't have to necessarily have their own account. But there aren't a lot of services like that out there, especially for stuff like Nintendo Switch games or any of the other consoles that are out there. It's something that comes up a lot as a question with the members of the gaming roundtable. But it's something that there aren't really a lot of answers for yet, because the terms of service and the end user license agreements for a lot of these games, or the platforms that people are accessing the games through, don't really allow for the kind of access that libraries provide in their spaces. You couldn't just create accounts on Steam and have those running on a lab computers for people to access freely, because then you have multiple people logging into these accounts, and Steam doesn't like that. And it makes sense, because it's a safety issue, especially if you're having kids logging into those accounts. So it's a conundrum for sure. Something that we don't really have an answer for yet.
Mm. I feel like I ended on a down note there. But you do the Game RT, the Roundtable, does have a Twitch channel where you stream, ALA Game RT, and you have a website, toplayishuman.com.
Yes.
Anything else you want to say before we go?
Just use your libraries, support your libraries. Even if you have, you know, the means to buy all the books and games you could ever want, not everybody in your community does. So even just signing up for a library card is a way to support your library. And your library probably has some cool stuff that you didn't even know that they had. If you listen to audiobooks, you can listen to lots of audiobooks for free through your library just with your library card. You can, you know, talk to your library if you want to see game collections and programming there. You can submit those requests to your library. Librarians are cool people. We love to try to provide the things that our communities are asking for if we have the means to do it. So we would definitely like to see communities loving the libraries that they have.
Rebecca Strang, thank you so much.
Thank you.